Winter is here, and so is all the coughing and sneezing it brings. Now's the time to make sure your immune system is as strong as it can be. You've heard me talk about how I've used Empower to supercharge my immune system. Now my friends at the Harmony Company have introduced a new and improved version of Empower called Empower Plus. This improved formula combines HCC, one of the most powerful mushroom extracts, with fermented wheat germ extract. Super concentrate, supercharging your immune system like never before. With more than 150 combined published research reports, Empower Plus will quickly give your immune system the super boost you need. So if you're looking for a way to handle whatever the winter throws at you, Empower Plus is the solution. For more information and to order, go to theharmonycompany.com. That's theharmonycompany.com. Or call 800-422-5518. 800-422-5518. Use coupon code HOFFMAN10 at checkout and get a 10% discount and free shipping. That's theharmonycompany.com for the new Empower Plus. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest is Dr. Carmen Fong. Dr. Fong is a proctologist. The other formal term for that is she's a colorectal surgeon. I believe that's the formal title.
Yep.
She has written a great book, Constipation Nation, What to Know When You Can't Go. And during the break, I just wanted to wet my whistle a little bit, so I reached for a cup of decaf. On the subject of constipation, is this is with or without caffeine? Is coffee something that's going to help keep me regular?
In some people, yes. You know, which isn't a great answer, but people always ask me that. And there's actually been a bunch of, you know, New York Times articles talking about coffee saying, oh, you know, when I smell my coffee, I go to the bathroom.
It's a conditioned reflex, right?
Definitely, yeah. Pavlovian, and yes. That you're like, oh, I smell my coffee, I go, or like I drink my first sip and I go. It doesn't work that fast. So what we do know helps is warm water going through the GI tract. And in some studies, it's shown that the phenols, like the chemicals inside coffee, are what stimulates the GI tract, not necessarily the caffeine. So that's why they've done studies where caffeine is like, or the caffeinated coffee is slightly better, but otherwise warm water also works and decaf coffee also works.
Yeah, there's this whole thing, in naturopathic medicine about coffee enemas. And the thought is that somehow, you know, through the portal vein, it goes right up to the liver. It's a liver detox. But it's certainly, I mean, that's going to prompt evacuation, you know.
Yeah. You can do any kind of enema and it will stimulate the rectum to, and poop everything out. On the subject of enema, since that is also a topic. You know, I don't generally advise colonics, like high colonic cleanses.
It creates dependency or is it dangerous or what?
Creates dependence. You know, there's risk of perforating the colon, which is, you know, there could be a hole in the colon that causes sepsis and you could get really sick. And it also, regular colonics can disrupt the microbiome, cleaning out the good bacteria that's in there. And then it doesn't know how to function anymore.
Right.
Once in a while, it's probably okay, but I wouldn't do it regularly.
I think some people get a little carried away with that sort of detox, you know, that somehow they're purging their body of...
Purging toxins and like for weight loss. And, you know, if you purge everything, you know, once a week, you're not going to gain any weight, which is one thing, but I think at some risk to your GI health.
Right.
And then in the same vein, enemas... You know, enemas are totally fine, especially if you're chronically constipated, really, really need that help to go. It's a little bit less disruptive than colonics. But again, I wouldn't do it every day. I wouldn't become dependent on it by doing an enema every day, even if it's just tap water or saline, not even like, you know, fleets like sodium phosphate.
Well, you mentioned when you said, you know, wake up and smell the coffee and then all of a sudden you kind of get the urge that it is kind of a conditioned reflex that some people, you know, it's like when they, you know, open up to the New York Times, it's like time to, you know, sit on the throne because it's a routine. How important are routines in establishing regular bowel habits? Because sometimes when I talk to my patients about constipation, I ask, do you set aside a regular time of the day when you normally have a bowel movement? They go, no, you know, I just wait till I really have to go. But maybe that's not the best way to do it. You know, just like irregular sleep habits may not be conducive to good sleep patterns.
Yes. So two answers to that. One is that, you know, we know that circadian rhythm actually has a big effect on GI motility. And so most people, you know, if you get your normal 6 to 8 hours of sleep every night, your gut has the time to rest and digest. Mm-hmm. And then so by the time you wake up in the morning, you go to the bathroom, right? Whether it's like 7 a.m. or 9 a.m., like after you sleep. So there is that part where once you're in a normal circadian rhythm, you can go to the bathroom. And that's part of the reason why people get so messed up when they travel.
Jet lag, so yeah.
You go to a different time zone and suddenly you're like waking up in the middle of the night. You know, your lunch is at midnight. And so you're like, hey, it's like, what are we doing? And so then you can't poop, right? Yep. So that's the one thing. On the other hand, my one bowel commandment is go when you have to go and don't go when you don't. So, you know, part of the reason why people get hemorrhoids is they kind of, you know, go and force themselves to go to the bathroom and sit for too long in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so all that pressure builds up in your anus. And so I don't think there's any reason to sit on the bathroom for an hour. My general rule is if you wake up in the morning and you don't feel like you have to go to the bathroom yet, go walk around, you know, drink a cup of warm water, a cup of coffee, go do the dishes or whatever. And by the time you go back to the bathroom, your GI tract is stimulated. It's awake, you know, things have mixed a little bit more. And, you know, when something is kind of knocking at the door, then you should go.
Right.
And then on the other side of the coin, though, you know, if you're really have to go, you should go and you shouldn't hold it in either. Right. Who's holding it in?
Because you're overriding the signals, you know.
Mm. You're overriding the signal. You're tightening your internal sphincter and your mm-hmm. external sphincter. And that causes anal fissures, which is more painful than
right. So there's this whole craze, I remember it in the 80s and 90s, about, you know, that the Western way of going to the bathroom is really not that physiologic. You know, sort of paleo man, you know, would just kind of squat down on their haunches.
Yeah.
And it was actually a better way to achieve, you know, proper coordination of the defecatory muscles, et cetera. And so it was suggested that people get a squatty potty. You remember that squatty potty craze? I don't know if you're old enough to remember. And or sometimes, you know, you'd see people, you know, in a public toilet, like, you know, taking their shoes off and then putting their feet on the side of the toilet, on the top of the toilet seat and squatting into the toilet.
Oh, my God.
Because that's more than, quote, natural way. And then, of course, you know, modern man, we've spent a lot of time on the toilet, you know, because we have a lot of diversions to sit on the toilet. And maybe that's not so good.
Oh, my gosh. So first of all, I would never take my shoes off and stand on a toilet. I do know about squatty potties. People ask me about this all the time. And squatty potty is, you know, the one statistic I found was that it's useful for about 15 to 20% of people.
Okay.
For people who actually need that change in the anal rectal angle, where are you, if you actually scrunch it up, you push your rectum down so that you can. Most people, which is everybody else, does not need a squatty potty or any kind of assistance. And sitting on the toilet the way it is just fine. So then I get asked that question, like, you know, if you're a dog or a monkey, you poop squatting down. But humans have also evolved to not be dogs and monkeys, and we stand upright and not on all fours, and mm-hmm. we don't walk on all fours. So our colons are actually a lot straighter, right? Our colon and our rectum, even though they're still like that little twist of the sigmoid. Again, another reason why squatty potties only help in a certain percentage of people. So when my patients ask me that and they say, do I need a squatty potty? I usually say, if you have one and it works for you, keep using it. But if you don't have one, then that's not the first thing I would try. I would optimize everything else first, like diet, behavior, water intake, exercise, before we need to throw a squatty potty at it. Almost never do I have to add a squatty potty to the mix.
Okay. Well, so should people worry about constipation? Because it has been associated with certain things like gallstones, for example. Mm-hmm. Is it associated with colon cancer? Does it affect levels of female hormones? Because, you know, there's this enterohepatic circulation, which takes care of your excess estrogen. And could you possibly engender a higher risk of uterine or breast cancer because you're constipated. You know, all these worries emerge about constipation.
Yeah, very good question. So far, there was like one small study that showed that constipation had a link to breast cancer, but I did not think it was very convincing. What we do know is that constipation, you know, is related to inflammation. So having some stool chronically sit in your colon isn't good for anybody. Mm-hmm. And it definitely causes diverticular disease, right?
So, right, that for sure.
You know, so like outpouchings in the colon. And that, you know, as you, and you know as well as I do, you have the two-hit hypothesis where if you have the genetic predisposition to cancer, for example, and then have that second inflammatory hit on top of it, you might be more predisposed to colon cancer.
Right.
That's all we know. Yeah, no direct link. The early onset colorectal cancer, you know, that's, you know, been a, and it was a passion of mine a few years ago. Cancer in people younger than 45, that instance has been increasing in the last 10 years. What we think now is that it's definitely diet related, possibly constipation related, and low levels of calcium. Low levels of calcium and decreased dairy intake, which I think is really interesting. I think we're going to probably find, you know, like the Surgeon General's recent warning, alcohol probably has something to do with it.
Binge drinking among younger people, potentially.
Yeah, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You being a colorectal surgeon, you probably are aware of the history of your profession because there was this guy named Dennis Burkitt, I believe, who was a surgeon who was in the UK, and he kind of got bored doing colorectal surgery. So he took a sabbatical and he went down to Uganda, and he looked around at the people there and he said, "Torn any people who have diverticulosis or colon cancer, I would go out of business here." And then he, then he developed the theory that everyone's stool should float because it's necessary to have frequent bowel movements to avoid colon cancer and so on, all manner of GI mishaps.
Yeah, all of that completely true. I think the interesting thing is, you know, I have said in the book several times that constipation is a disease of civilization. You know, they also call it the white man's curse because of our diets. I get asked that question though, about floating poop. Poop does not.
I don't think it does.
Doesn't have to float 100%.
Don't get upset if it,
No, poop does not have to float. In fact, I actually think it most of the time shouldn't float. Mm-hmm. Things that make it float would be super, super fibrous foods or it's fatty. Right?
Yeah.
And so in those cases, you know, you don't want it to be super fatty or you don't want it to be super fibrous. You actually want it to be, have some protein, have some digestible carbs, and it should sink. Like, I wouldn't worry too much.
And if you're concerned, just consult the Bristol Stool scale, which I think a lot of people obsessively look at. You know, it ranges from, you know, like pebbles to, you know, an unformed mass. And you could rate yourself on the Bristol Stool scale. I think that's a little bit OCD.
Yeah. People will be like, oh, you know, you have to be a 3 or a 4. And honestly, I kind of considered not putting, you know, the Bristol Stool scale in there because I didn't want people to obsess over it. But I wanted to have, you know, a baseline for people to work from and say, hey, you know, when it's too hard and it's pebbles, this is constipation, right? You want to be somewhere in the middle where it's kind of like formed but snake-like, but not loose.
So we hit some of the misconceptions about constipation, but what are some of the others that you mentioned in the book?
Yeah. So I would say that the major one is that fiber causes constipation, which is, again, only if it's too much fiber. Mm-hmm. And then things that, you know, have fiber in it, I get asked a lot, like, what actually has fiber in it? Fiber is a carbohydrate, so it's found in fruits and vegetables and beans. I always forget the beans and seeds and nuts, but not in things like chicken or beef or fish. So there's no fiber in those things. The other things that I tend to have to ask, you know, people ask questions about are, how often do we poop? But I think we answered that question in the first segment, like 1 to 3 times.
What's normal? Yeah, that whole thing. Yeah. Right. So what are, you know, you kind of did a deep dive into the history of this. And, you know, what are some of the most unusual approaches to constipation that you came across? Because, you know, medicine has a checkered past in terms of things that have been applied before the scientific method took precedence. So what did you find?
The history part was probably one of my favorite chapters to write, you know, about how James Kellogg developed granola, and that was meant to be a health, which helped, you know, people go to the bathroom and be more healthy and more regular. But one of the little known facts was that Nikola Tesla and Mark Twain were friends, and they lived in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Like, I would have loved to see this, but they would just visit each other's, like, you know, homes and labs in the middle of the day. And so Mark Twain was known to have constipation. And so one day he just, like, walked over to Tesla's lab and, like, hey, you know, I'm having some constipation. He was known to have, like, a diet of just meat and beer and potatoes. So Tesla put him on a machine, which he called the earthquake machine. And it was basically just this oscillating platform. And he shook Mark Twain for about 2 minutes. And Mark Twain immediately ran off and jumped into the bathroom and went to the bathroom. Yeah. So it was the earthquake machine.
I had envisioned some sort of electrical apparatus. Thank goodness it wasn't that, you know, because Tesla was, like, all about, you know, sparking, arcing, you know, electrical machines.
The funny thing is, you know, there is kind of a predecessor to, like, other abdominal massagers that people have tried, you know, literally things that will shake the stool out. There are also some transcutaneous, so going through the skin, electrodes that there was one study in Australia where you put little electrodes onto the abdomen, onto the belly, and that stimulates your colon as well. That sounds more like something like you think Tesla would have done.
So that actually brings up an issue, which is, you know, and I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, waging the war against constipation. I think you start with, you know, simple methods, and then you kind of raise the ante, use maybe natural supplements, and then get into some of the medications. We'd like to talk about that. But there are people who have what it can be termed end stage constipation. No way, no how can they move their bowels spontaneously.
Yeah.
And this is really a terrible situation. My understanding is that even now, but eventually they'll perfect this, they have pacemakers for the heart.
Yeah.
They are developing pacemakers for the bladder.
Yeah.
And eventually since the colon is a much more complex organ than the heart in some ways, because the heart just pumps the peristalsis, and the equilibrium of the colon is much more complex. But eventually they'll create something with maybe an AI brain that can help to replace the normal electrical impulses that propel the musculature. Is that on the drawing board when you go to your conferences and you hear about the latest breakthroughs?
Yeah. So there are transcutaneous, like I said, through the abdomen, through the skin devices that stimulate the colon. But Dr. Satish Rao, he's actually a gastroenterologist, not a colorectal surgeon, over in Augusta, Georgia. They're developing the Vibrant capsule, which is also in the book. Which is a capsule that goes in, you ingest it, you eat it, and then swallow it, and then it goes into your gut, and it goes into your colon, and then depending on the programming, it's supposed to simulate the colon motility, so it shakes until the stool comes. And multiple studies were that it shook, you know, once in the morning and once at night to simulate the natural circadian rhythm for colon, and then they varied that a little bit. As of the last printing, I think that they were going to have it FDA approved. Or the first printing, have an FDA approved. I haven't seen it yet in real life, which is kind of interesting. I would be very, very interested to see if this works. As you know now, if you have end stage constipation, which is just nothing has helped, you have one of two options, right? One is total abdominal colectomy, which
take
the whole thing out. You get an end colostomy, or you just get a colostomy, which is that we'll just go into a bag, which is totally fine and acceptable, but we try to reserve surgery for my last resort.
But I think through, you know, electronics, eventually they will have pacemakers for the gastrointestinal tract, you know, working on, you know, wherever there's a problem.
I agree. Like a pacemaker between, you know, a combination of a pacemaker and a gut microbiome, you know, just changing the microbiome, I think we can optimize, you know, the constipation.
With custom probiotics, because not different probiotics work differently for different people. and not over-the-counter ones. Some, you know, can help, but they're not surefire, and maybe they'll crack the code on which ones are most beneficial. So let's back up, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what are some of the natural herbs that you recommend, and what are some of the ones that you discourage people from taking?
Yeah. The very easy way to remember which fruits to take, which will help with constipation, is the peas. Like, I call them all the peas. So pears, prunes, papaya, pineapple. And then very lately, I've discovered prickly pear, which is a type of cactus, also helps with constipation, because all of those things have, again, like the apple, a very good blend of both soluble and insoluble fibers. So whenever people ask me, oh, you know, what's some natural things you could take? Prunes always comes to mind, but I try to add the other peas in it, so you have a variety of options.
And what about kiwis? Because kiwis have the reputation of also being beneficial, and there's some products extracts of kiwi.
Kiwis 100%. So eating one or two kiwis a day will help you go to the bathroom. You're right. There has been a lot of really good research in that recently. It does show up in my book. I always forget that one because it doesn't start with a P. Mm-hmm. So we have to find some way to remember.
It's a different mnemonic. I hear bananas can jam you up. And the reason I know that is because I read the book Hawaii by James Michener. And on that voyage, they from the mainland to Hawaii, they packed away bananas for the missionaries and the original settlers, white settlers of Hawaii. And they became terribly constipated. Is it true that bananas are a little constipating, aren't they?
They are. So the funny thing about bananas, though, is that greener bananas can tend to be constipating, and riper bananas are actually better for you. So the more digested the sugar is, the less constipating it is. So when you're green, they're a little bit less digested. But the thing with the green bananas is that they're actually a very good prebiotic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because they have a lot of good vitamins, and they have like the starches that the microbiome loves. Mm-hmm. So when people ask me about bananas, I say eat a mix of green bananas and ripe bananas, or somewhere in between, but you don't have to stick with one or the other.
I've heard about resistant starch, and the way to get that is you reheat rice or you reheat potatoes. And there's a kitchen chemistry by which they become resistant, and they become a prebiotic, and they're good for that.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so those are the two other examples I usually use is with rice and potatoes.
Okay.
Yep.
One of my go-tos that it had been helpful in my practice is magnesium, but there are different forms of magnesium. I think magnesium citrate, which is offered in a liquid, you can take it as an orally or an enema, it flushes you out. But more gently, you can just take some over-the-counter magnesium, right?
Correct. Yeah. Magnesium is a great one. Again, that electrolyte supplementation. So magnesium glycinate, I found a lot of research is good, but you can honestly take any of them because a lot of the magnesium these days, whenever I recommend it to patients, it comes in a complex. So it's a few of them, magnesium oxide, glycinate, and citrate. And there's one other one I can't remember.
3-8 is a newer one for sort of.
Yes, correct. Citrate though, is used as a, you know, bowel regimen for pre-op or pre-colonoscopy, but it also comes in a gummy called Natural Carm, and that I find is like a lot easier for people to take. It's not, you know, as gassy. It doesn't cause as much gas and bloating. It's a lot gentler on the stomach.
Okay. So what about all these other, you know, these Senna type things and bad news, right? Because they create dependency and melanosis coli. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So Senna is kind of funny because people are like, oh, Senna's natural. And it's true. It comes from
an Ex-Lax, right?
Yes, it is an Ex-Lax. But Senna and Dulcolax are stimulant laxatives, which means that as opposed to Miralax, which is an osmotic laxative and just draws in water to help your stools become sandy.
So not going to create dependency with Miralax, but with the others, potentially, yes.
Yes. Over long-term use, you can be dependent on Senacot and Dulcolax, so that causes stimulation, pull and contraction, and stimulates motility. Melanosis coli is that over long-term use of using a stimulant laxative, you get these little black spots, like little darker spots on the inside of your colon. They're not necessarily something that you would see as a person or you would know about, but you know, when you get a colonoscopy, colonoscopists can see it.
Yeah.
in the colon and can tell that you've been using laxatives long term.
Right. So it's a little bit like a fortune teller, like, how'd you know? Well, yeah. I can see right Ta-da. Through you. I see right through you. Yeah. Okay. So we did touch upon exercise, but is not exercise a very good way to maintain regular bowel habits? And of course, that being Americans being so sedentary, that I think is a factor that's involved.
So moderate exercise is best, you know, not completely sedentary lifestyle where we're just playing video game or watching TVs all day, TV all day. But 30 minutes, three times a week, moderate exercise is great. I just always point out too, though, that too much exercise is also bad for GI motility in that if you're working out too hard, your body goes into a fight or flight response, response where it's like, oh my gosh, you know, you're running away from a lion, you're running away from danger, and that actually shuts down your...
sympathetic, which is constipating as opposed to parasympathetic, which is relaxing.
Right. Correct. So you're not doing the rest and digest, you're doing the fight or flight. And so when your body's constantly in fight or flight, you actually have more constipation problems.
Well, great. You've obviously really thought this through. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions about since you deal often with hemorrhoids. So obviously having normal bowel movements and not pressing down is going to have a preventive impact on hemorrhoids. And are there any, what's the latest, greatest, newest technique on hemorrhoids? There's rubber banding, there's the scalpel surgery. Are there any new ingenious ways of dealing with hemorrhoids?
So there's about 8 ways of dealing with hemorrhoids that you learn as a subspecialist, as a colorectal surgeon, starting from, you know, topical medications, going to excisional hemorrhoidectomy, which is the gold standard, right? We're cutting off the entire column and stitching. But people are terribly afraid of hemorrhoidectomies because of all the horror stories you can read online. So, and there's all the things in between, though. We used to do phenol injections, which is injecting a sclerosing agent into the hemorrhoids, and that kind of gets rid of them. Right now, my preferred method is actually rubber banding, hemorrhoid ligation.
Mm-hmm. That's been around for a while, right?
Yeah, it's been around for 20 years. But a good ligation actually is very, very effective. Effective about, you know, 65 to 75% of the time versus excisional hemorrhoidectomy, which we know has a recurrence rate of about 8 to 12%. So somewhere in between, I would always do banding first. It's less painful. It's less downtime. So hemorrhoid ligation. And then one of the newest things, though, that we've been working on, and they actually do it a lot more in the UK, is laser. Is laser hemorrhoidectomy. So you're just doing laser ablation or sclerosing of that hemorrhoidal vein, burns, and it works well in some people and it works well on certain hemorrhoids. It's not my first go-to. There's also infrared coagulation, which is slightly different from laser, but that just causes like a thermal effect, which burns the hemorrhoid. It does tend to cause a little more pain, though. Banding is somewhere in between. Less painful, less downtime. I should mention, THD, transanal hemorrhoidal dearterialization, is a technique I've been doing for some time. And it is a, again, like an in-between doing nothing, doing banding, or doing an excisional hemorrhoidectomy. So this is where I Doppler all 6 pedicles of blood vessels in the anus, so where the blood flow is, and I hear it via ultrasound. And once I hear it, I actually suture up those vessels. And then I perform a little mucopexy, which is I tie up the mucosa and pull it up. So in addition to cutting off the blood flow that goes through the hemorrhoids, you're also pulling up that excess mucosa, that excess tissue, so that it doesn't pop down anymore.
Is it a little bit like embolization in a way? Or is the idea behind it similar to that?
It's more like ligation, because you're ligating vessels.
Okay.
Ligating the vessels that go to the anus. Works very, very well for prolapsing and bleeding hemorrhoids.
Well, doctor, unfortunately, I don't think you'll be short of clientele in the near term, because this is going to be a ubiquitous problem, you know, one way or another, whether it's, you know, constipation. Oh, let me just reflect briefly on the past decade or so, some new medications have come online that are more working on the fundamentals of constipation. Can you talk about those briefly and the upsides, downsides of those? Because they go beyond the over-the-counter remedies.
Yes. So the prescription medications for constipation, there's actually about half a dozen of them. The most common ones are Linzess and Amitizia. Linzess and Amitizia. And these work by, again, increasing absorption in the colon. So increase absorbing more water so that the stools will be soft and so that
They turn on the floodgates into the interior of the bowel, in effect.
Yep, exactly. Yep. So you're washing everything out. The problem I found, though, is that in real life, in my patients, there will be some other doctor who put them on Linzess, but they're still not drinking enough water. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of one of those things where I feel like one pill doesn't solve the problem if the rest of the behaviors haven't been adjusted. And so you can
just need an all of the above approach. Yeah.
I think you need all of the above. And then if you still need to throw a pill on top of it, you throw a pill on top of it. But the pill in and of itself usually doesn't cure it. I had one patient once who was on Linzess but only drank Diet Coke all day. And I was like, whereas, you know, you do have some of the fluid, there's also not enough fluid. And then the sugar makes it like big.
Even the diet, the artificial sugars may upset the microbiome in some way.
Yep. And so that wasn't working. So we actually just got off of the diet soda and then tried to increase, you know, with a fiber supplement, increase water and electrolytes. And that did work.
So welcome to my world. Sometimes you end up being a medical nutritionist at the, you know, after all, and you stay out of the operating room.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's a lot of what we do as doctors is actually, you know, counseling and reassuring on diet and exercise.
Indeed. Well, great stuff. And you have a very balanced approach to, a very pervasive problem. The book is Constipation Nation, What to Know When You Can't Go. And do you have an online presence where people can find out more about you?
I do, actually. It's www.carmenfond.com. You can also go to constipationnation.com, but we're actually revamping the website a little bit, so it just redirects to carmenfond.com right now. You can find all of the other articles I've written, the op-meds, some poetry, etc.
Oh.
More information about constipation and my blog.
Constipationnation.substack.com is a place where you can find some of your writings. Great stuff. Well, I think you're the consummate clinician because you take a very, very comprehensive approach to problems that your patients need you for. So thanks very much for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me. Like, I love your podcast just because you really do break it down for people and education is a huge part of what we do, you know? Colorectal surgery isn't sexy, but it's at least necessary.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, there's a lot of proctologist jokes. Like, did you go to a party? Do they give you some, you know, they think, whoa, what do you do? Or, you know, maybe you're on a cruise ship. You go, I'm a proctologist.
You have no idea. Like, dentists and proctologists.
It's tough being you. It's tough being
you. Most feared and most hated. But then once we solve your problem, you kind of love us. So
it's like taking the proverbial thorn out of the lion's paw, right?
Exactly.
You know, people are forever indebted. Well, thanks very much, Dr. Fong, for joining us. Really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations. You're listening to Intelligent Medicine, a resource to help you take control of your health. We offer a balanced, objective analysis of all your health, wellness, and aging options, both conventional and alternative. Now you can take your engagement to the next level by joining Fullscript. Fullscript is my online dispensing platform that only offers curated, professional-grade supplement brands that I know and trust. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com for more information and to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site, it's safe, secure, and HIPAA compliant and offers world-class support. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals, including my custom targeted protocols that combine the products I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. It's all at DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com.